Our study this afternoon will cover the final two stages of Jesus' trial before the Romans. As we begin, I want to read through the account from the composite gospel. When Pilate heard Galilee mentioned, he asked if the man was a Galilean. When he found out that he was in Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem during those days. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had wanted to see him for a long time, because he had heard many things about him. He hoped to see some miracle done by him. He questioned him with many words, but he gave no answers. The chief priests and the scribes stood vehemently accusing him. Herod with his soldiers humiliated him and mocked him. Dressing him in luxurious clothing, they sent him back to Pilate. Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that day. Before that, they were enemies with each other. Pilate called together the chief priests and the rulers of the people and said to them, "You brought this man to me as one that perverts the people, and see, I have examined him before you, and found no basis for a charge against this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. Neither has Herod, for I sent you to him, and see, nothing worthy of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him, and release him." Now at the feast the governor was accustomed to release to the multitude one prisoner whom they desired. There was a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Barabbas was a robber, one who was thrown into prison for a certain revolt in the city and for murder. He was actually bound with those who had made insurrection, men who in the insurrection had committed murder. So the multitude, crying aloud, began to ask him to do as he always did for them. When therefore they were gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews? Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew that because of envy they had delivered him up. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." Now he had to release one prisoner to them at the feast, so he said, "You have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Therefore, do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews?" Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitudes to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. But the governor answered them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" Then they all shouted again, saying, "Not this man. Away with this man. Release to us Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do to Jesus, whom you call Christ, the King of the Jews?" They all said to him, "Let him be crucified. Crucify him." So Pilate then took Jesus and flogged him. The soldiers twisted thorns into a crown and put it on his head and dressed him in a purple garment. They kept saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they kept slapping him. Then Pilate went out again and said to them, "Behold, I bring him out to you, that you may know that I find no basis for a charge against him." Jesus therefore came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple garment. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." When therefore the chief priests and the officers saw him, they shouted, saying, "Crucify! Crucify!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no basis for a charge against him." Then Pilate spoke to them again, wanting to release Jesus, but they shouted, saying, "Crucify! Crucify him!" He said to them the third time, "Why? What evil has this man done? I have found no capital crime in him. I will therefore chastise him and release him." The Jews cried out exceedingly, saying, "Let him be crucified. We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." When therefore Pilate heard this saying, he was the more afraid. He entered into the praetorium again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Pilate therefore said to him, "Aren't you speaking to me? Don't you know that I have power to release you, and have power to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power at all against me unless it were given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me to you has greater sin." At this Pilate was seeking to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release this man, you aren't Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." When Pilate therefore heard these words, he brought Jesus out, and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the preparation day of the Passover, at about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." But they were urgent with loud voices. They cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Their voices and the voices of the chief priests prevailed. Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So when Pilate saw that nothing was being gained, but rather that a disturbance was starting, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this righteous person. You see to it." All the people answered, "May his blood be on us and on our children." So then Pilate, wishing to please the multitude, decreed that what they asked for should be done. He released to them Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but he delivered Jesus up to their will. Jesus was flogged and delivered to be crucified, so they took Jesus away and led him away. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the hall within the court, which is the praetorium, and gathered the whole garrison together against him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. They braided a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and a reed in his right hand, and they kneeled down before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" They spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head, and bowing their knees, they worshipped him. When they had mocked him, they took the purple robe off of him and put his clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. Before we work our way through some of the events of these passages or notice some other things about, in particular, some people involved in Jesus' final these final stages of Jesus' trial, I want to mention something about the order of events as they appear in this composite gospel, as well as how McGarvey deals with them in his commentary. The accounts of Jesus' trials, especially the portions we have under consideration, are in some ways very difficult to harmonize, and I debated on whether or not I wanted to read these accounts from the composite gospel, as it kind of raises several questions to which there may not be satisfactory answers. On the one hand, I appreciate the fuller narrative the composite gospel can give you by combining all four accounts in this way, and it just feels like the story is more complete. But one major issue we face in harmonizing these particular passages in the gospels, and we face it at other times too, is the problem of chronology. This is not a problem only for the composite gospel, but for anyone who sets about trying to harmonize the four gospels down to the very minute and smallest detail. Generally, all of the gospel authors and writers follow the same overarching chronological order of events. You'll find Jesus' temptation toward the beginning of the book and his crucifixion toward the end. Big things like that fall into the same place. The problem comes when we start looking for this same rigid, detailed chronology down to the finest details of many of the events in the life and ministry of Jesus, and such is the case with this passage. For example, one of the things that stuck out to me as I read these passages in the composite gospel is that there are seemingly two accounts of the soldiers in the praetorium mockingly dressing Jesus up as a king, taking his clothes from him, worshiping him, ridiculing him, and beating him at different points of the trial. There are also two mentions that Jesus was scourged or flogged at seemingly different stages. John's gospel places these two events near the middle of this stage of Jesus' trial, while Matthew and Mark's gospels mention them at the end as he's delivered to be crucified and led away from the crowd. And this has led some people, some scholars, to believe that Jesus may have experienced two different scourges of different severity during the course of his trial. I'm not convinced that this is a necessary conclusion due to this issue of chronology. Generally, none of the gospel writers strictly adhered to rigid chronological ordering in all the details of their gospels. In fact, sometimes they chose a different ordering system, such as by theme. So many times they grouped things in a thematic order rather than sequentially. And in this passage, Matthew and Mark do not seem very concerned about chronology or the order in which these things took place during the trial, but Luke and John seem to pay a bit more attention to the order of events as they give their accounts. McGarvey comments on the disparity between the timing of the scourging by simply saying, Mark mentions the scourging to show that it preceded the crucifixion, but we see from John's account that the scourging took place somewhat earlier in the proceeding. And McGarvey simply leaves it at that. That's all he says. On the one hand, as good as McGarvey's works may be, and in how much we might like the fourfold gospel, I would encourage you, no matter what resource it is, don't take a statement like this at face value and accept it as true simply because of the reputation of the person who said it. McGarvey does not provide any evidence for this claim or for this statement. That's not to say that there is no evidence to support it. There is some that you can find, but you need to examine that evidence and be presented with it before you agree and accept that position. Further, there is evidence worth considering, if you're interested in it, for the multiple views about the correct chronology of this account, but I don't think it's important enough for us to go through the different viewpoints at this time, as I'm going to explain here in just a moment. It seems to me that a combination of Luke and John's Gospels will give you the more accurate sequence of events of this trial, and that should be enough for our purposes as we study the Gospels, because even with their Gospels, I don't think that they intended to present a step-by-step accurate record of the order of events of these trials. You have to be somewhat careful in looking for a detailed chronology of events, as that's often not the priority of the Gospel writers. So if we were to focus too much on what happened and when, I think we're missing the point the authors were trying to convey. Their focus seems to be to present the reality of the mockery of justice that was made by these trials, while also highlighting what the Lord did for us, what he was willing to face, the depths of suffering, of shame, and the sorrows that the Savior endured on our behalf. Consider, if you will, this list of emotional and physical abuse that I compiled as I studied, which the Lord suffered all before facing the cross, starting from the night of his arrest, the very beginning of this series of events. He was betrayed by one of his disciples with a kiss. He was arrested, at which time the other disciples deserted him. He was denied 3 times by one of his closest friends. He was slapped when he brought before the high priest for speaking the truth. He was blindfolded, beaten, spat on, and blasphemed as the Christ, called upon in a mocking way to prophesy who was hitting him while he was blindfolded. He was treated with contempt, mocked, and dressed up in a bright robe by Herod and his soldiers. He was flogged and scourged by the Romans. He was slapped, beaten, stripped, mockingly dressed as a king, and worshipped by the soldiers of the Praetorium, feigning worship and honor to him, who jammed a crown of thorns on his head and gave him a reed in his right hand, which they then took and beat him with it. He was presented to the people after his scourging, after his various beatings, in this mock outfit, bloodied and bruised, and presented as their king. He was sentenced to crucifixion by the vehement and persistent cries of his own people, of the rulers and the religious leaders of the day. The gospel records highlight the injustices which Jesus faced. They were not cold, clinical lists of the events as they took place in order. They were written to show the heart-wrenching reality of the rejection and abuse that the Lord endured that day, but we might ask ourselves the question, why? Just as many were appalled at you, my people, so his appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men, Isaiah 52:14. But he was pierced through for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities, the chastening of our peace fell upon him, and by his wounds we are healed, Isaiah 53:5. Who himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, so that having died to sin we might live to righteousness, by his wounds you were healed, 1 Peter 2:24. I'm not saying that it's not worthwhile to study these passages and attempt to understand exactly what happened, and how many times each thing happened, and in what order it may have happened. By no means do we wish to belittle or underestimate how much the Lord suffered, how much he endured. But we have to be careful not to get lost in difficult questions that people may raise, like, how many times was he scourged? How many times was he mocked, dressed as a king, or beaten? The fact is, these things all happened. He was beaten. He was bruised. He was slapped, spat on, mocked, disrespected, humiliated, deserted, betrayed, deemed only worthy of death to take away our sins. The gospel writers wanted us to know all the things which Jesus had to endure. And that is an overarching message of the events of Jesus' arrest, his trials, and his crucifixion. Something I did throughout the time studying for this particular section of our Gospel Harmony study is something I want to recommend all of you do yourselves. And that is return to these passages. Return to this list of sufferings, the emotional and physical abuse, and all of these passages listed along with them. Take stock of your life. If you find in your life, or you know in your life, that there's something lacking, something sinful that you've been ignoring, or worse, indulging in and enjoying, or if you've been lazy and not giving your all, giving your best to Jesus and to the work of the gospel, to the kingdom, for whatever reason, if you haven't dealt with that problem, with that sin, or you haven't sought ways to serve God, to get up and to go to work, whatever the failure may be, whatever the trouble may be, let me suggest, take some time, return to these passages, read them, dwell on them, imagine them, think them through in painstaking detail. Make yourself understand what the Lord suffered for you and for me. You'll find yourself humbled, humiliated. Your priorities will be reset. Your mindset will be clear. Your attitude will be adjusted. And if you love the Lord, you'll make those wrongs right in your life, in light of the depths of his mercy, his grace, and the unspeakable riches of his love, demonstrated by his endurance of the abuses of his arrest, his trials, and his crucifixion. You'll know where to start working. You'll know what your next steps will be. Your life will become better. The church will be better for it. The scriptures give us that stern warning. Those who turn back to sin after having a knowledge of the grace and mercy and love of God, for them there remains no sacrifice, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment. Let's not be in that situation. Turn away from those things. Make your life right with Christ and with God. For the rest of our time, I wanted to look a bit at some of the men involved in these stages of Jesus' trial. First, I wanted to talk about the two judges who he had to stand before, about Herod and Pilate. And I started by kind of asking the question, who was Herod? And I hope this information will help you as you go back and study these passages, as you read them, especially if you read them like we did today from the composite gospel or this combined narrative, that this will add to your understanding, add some historical and other contextual flavor that helps you to really kind of understand the nature of these men and how they interacted with the Lord. Herod Antipas was a tetrarch ruling the region of Galilee. We also know that he was an Idumean. An Idumea was the Greco-Roman name for Edom, whose territory now expanded far beyond the borders of ancient Edom. Herod's father was also an Idumean, and his mother was a Samaritan. So Herod has some Jewish roots, some Jewish heritage in his bloodline. From what we read about him in the New Testament, and if you include some historical notes, we learn that he has a very shallow interest in the religious aspects of his Jewishness, of his heritage. For example, coins in his territory did not carry the image of Caesar, something that was offensive to the Jews, these graven images. On one occasion, he sided with the Jewish protesters of the land when Pilate had votive shields and tablets erected in the palace of Herod. These were, again, graven images that offended the Jews. He also had an interest in the preaching of John the Immerser, which was later directed toward Jesus as he heard about the things which Jesus was doing, Luke 9 and verse 9. Herod's lifestyle is presented as very hedonistic, and it seems likely from his personality that the feasts of Judaism would have been one of the few things that may have piqued his interest. As I mentioned, Herod was not a ruler over Judea, where the trials of Jesus were taking place, but he ruled Galilee and Perea, regions up to the north in the land, so it's probable that he was in Jerusalem to attend the feast, to, from his perspective maybe, to go to a big party. Luke is the only gospel writer of the four who records in any detail the portion of the trial before Herod Antipas. And there's a stark contrast between the questioning which Jesus receives from Herod and his previous examination as he stood before Pilate. Apparently, none of the questions which Herod asked Jesus were even worth recording, nor did Jesus find them worth answering. It's possible that Herod spent his whole time before the Lord badgering Jesus for some miracle, as that's all he really wanted from him anyway. Long gone are those days when he gladly listened to a prophet of God, as he did with John the Immerser. On seeing that he wasn't getting what he wanted, Herod reacted as you might expect of a child. He and his soldiers dressed Jesus in fancy clothes fit for a king, mocked him, abused him, and sent him back to Pilate. So, let's explore the question a little bit of who was Pilate. Pontius Pilate was appointed a procurator of Judea in AD 26, and he was the fifth such governor of the troublesome region of Judea. According to some historians, his appointment was a bit surprising, as Pilate was outspokenly anti-Semitic, which can be seen by some of his conduct toward the Jews during his term. And there are some incidents of note that I want to mention, as I think they help us to understand Pilate's behavior toward Jesus throughout the trial. On one occasion, Pilate had some conflicts with them regarding some financial issues. He took large amounts of temple funds to complete the construction of a new city water supply system in Jerusalem. Now, taxes were already a sore spot for the Jews, so this act was seen as particularly invasive and offensive. In response to this, the public had planned to create an uproar in the streets, but Pilate got wind of it, and he utilized a secret police force disguised and dispersed among the protesters. On signal, they pulled out clubs, which they used to attack and disperse the crowd, causing many of the protesters to be killed. I believe Josephus made a note about this, that some of the protesters were killed by the trampling of their own brethren as they ran away in fear for their lives. Luke records an unprovoked massacre of Galileans in the midst of offering sacrifices in the temple, which is also cited as a reason why Pilate had a poor relationship with Herod Antipas. There were also several issues regarding the subject of graven images on armor, on standards, on coins, and decorative shields when Pilate stubbornly ignored the convictions of the Jews, and it was on one of these occasions that Herod sided with Jewish protesters, as we mentioned earlier. At least one of these incidents became so heated that word reached Emperor Tiberius, who ordered Pilate to remove the images, like a father having to come in and separate squabbling children. Pilate seemed to constantly bring friction and difficulty upon himself in his dealings with the Jews, and through this, the Jews became aware of just how tenuous the standing of a governor, a local governor, could be with the emperor at times. And by the time of Jesus' trial, Pilate's standing had seen better days, and we're going to notice how the Jews used this against him to get their way. With this brief look into a little bit of Pilate's history, I think it helps us to make sense of his conduct toward Jesus throughout this trial, which seems a little out of character. Some commentators mention that Pilate almost seems sympathetic to Jesus, as if he's trying to help him and doesn't really want to punish him. However, in many ways, it seems more likely that Pilate just wants to stay out of trouble. The first thing Pilate does in our account is to try and shift the responsibility of dealing with Jesus to someone else by sending him to Herod, but that ultimately fails. Herod finds no guilt in Jesus and sends him back to Pilate. After all, this was Jerusalem, which was under Pilate's jurisdiction. It seems a little strange that Pilate is so reluctant to sentence Jesus to death, considering the great crowd of his own people and many of the rulers who were gathered before him clamoring for crucifixion. Why didn't he just give them what they wanted? Was he really sympathetic to Jesus? I suppose that's possible, but I think it's highly likely that Pilate's past interactions with the Jews have made him much more cautious about causing any trouble in Judea. Surely Pilate was aware of the great triumphal entry of Jesus into Jerusalem just a few days ago. Jesus had a large number of faithful, loving, devoted followers. And surely to Pilate, this could turn into an army of zealous fanatics if their leader were put to death. After all, weren't these people before him just accusing Jesus of sedition and rebellion? Just a thought. It seems most things that happened around Jesus or regarding Jesus got around, word spread pretty quickly. And it wasn't but a few days ago, maybe a few hours ago, that Jesus' arrest took place. And during that occasion, one of Jesus' followers pulled his sword and attacked one of the men that had come to arrest him, and Jesus healed his ear. I'm sure that word of this miracle and the events surrounding it probably got around. It's possible Pilate knew this and may have thought, well, there you go. Some of his followers are ready and willing to fight. So Pilate was between a rock and a hard place. If he put Jesus to death, he risked the possibility of an uprising from the multitude of Jesus' followers. On the other, here before him stood a great crowd of angry people calling, demanding crucifixion. If he could not appease their bloodlust, then he would almost certainly have a problem. So Pilate tries a few different tactics. He tries offering an alternative punishment. He tries to force their hand by offering to release to them Barabbas or Jesus. And he tries humiliating Jesus. Luke records three times during Pilate's discussions with the people when he declares Jesus' innocence and offers, rather than crucifying Jesus, let him be chastised and released. And most likely this chastising refers to the scourging which Pilate orders for Jesus. As we noticed earlier, John's account tells us that that scourging took place around the middle of the trial rather than at the end, once Jesus was sentenced to crucifixion. It would also appear that after the scourging, or perhaps as part of it, the soldiers beat, mocked, and disrespectfully dressed him as a king to then bring him out before the people to embarrass him. Ultimately, all of Pilate's efforts failed. He could not find a compromise, and the Jews proceed to offer him a veiled threat, telling him, "If you release this man, you aren't Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." And so Pilate was beaten. He could not afford any more bad reports making their way to the emperor, and his only choice was to give the crowd what they wanted and hope that Jesus' followers would not create an uprising. It seems that perhaps if this was the internal struggle on Pilate's mind, that Jesus helped him in making his final decision when he assured Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be delivered over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not from here." John 18:36. And so finally, the verdict is given. Let him be crucified. Now briefly, I want to mention a few things about Barabbas. He's sort of an interesting character, starting with his name. The prefix bar in Jewish names means the son of whatever name follows it. In Barabbas' case, his name could mean son of the father, bar Abba, or son of the teacher, bar Abban. According to the early biblical scholar Origen and other commentators from early Christian history, the full name of Barabbas may have been Jesus Barabbas, since Jesus was a common first name. In fact, if you read Matthew's account in the Great Book translation, it actually refers to him as Jesus Barabbas. And though that might just be a coincidental oddity that maybe his name was Jesus, or a common first name at the time, I wanted to mention that since some of us do read from that translation and you might run into that from time to time, and I didn't want you to feel confused or wonder about it. But there is some interesting symbolism to be seen in the meanings of the name Barabbas and the way that Jesus took the place of that man in death, this son of the Father who was set free by what Jesus did for us on the cross. He's a picture of every man as a sinner and Jesus taking their place. And there's one other thing I wanted to note based on what little we know about Barabbas. The Gospels tell us that he was a robber, an insurrectionist, and a murderer. When we read this account and consider the choice between Jesus and Barabbas, it's easy for us to have the impression that the people must have been in an emotional frenzy to choose Barabbas over Jesus. Who in their right mind, when presented with this choice, do you want a murderer, an insurrectionist, or do you want the Messiah, the healer, the teacher, would choose the man who was a murderer? But aside from the charge of robbery, I think in some ways Barabbas strangely fit the incorrect Jewish expectations of the day of what the Messiah would be, more than Jesus did. Several commentators and historians argue that the rebellion in which Barabbas participated was one of the ones caused by Pilate's frequent offensive actions towards the Jews. And in that light, Barabbas may not seem so bad to the Jews. This was a man who had zeal for his nation. He was willing to fight back, to rebel, and even kill as he fought against the hated Roman overlords, much as they thought a conquering Messiah might come to do. This is not to say that they in any way viewed Barabbas as their Messiah. Rather, he was more like a zealot. But it's possible that in some ways this may have been an easier choice for them than we might assume, without that cultural, historical context. One more thing that struck me about Barabbas was this charge of insurrection. That's what the chief priests were saying Jesus was guilty of as they brought him to Pilate. And so Jesus was to take the place of someone who was guilty of the sin he was being charged with. Truly, that's a picture of the reality of him taking the place of all sinners. And that brought to my mind his previous conviction before the Jewish high priests, that of blasphemy. As we saw in that study, that was just a formality. It was an excuse to proceed, as they had to have false witnesses come forward to make up a false charge of blasphemy. But what's striking to me is that in the course of Jesus' trial before the high priests, they begin to falsely accuse him and mock him and beat him. They became guilty of the very sin, the very accusation themselves. So on two occasions, Jesus replaced a man guilty of the things he was charged with. He replaced Barabbas in death. And he was there to forever replace the high priests as our great high priest. Now, there are many other things we could study in this passage. You could write entire sermons off of many of the interactions that Jesus had, off of the sayings, off of so many of the details that are here in these passages. And there are more things than we have time to explore and discuss, but I hope that some of this background material and some of this historical and contextual material, some of these thoughts have helped give you a better understanding of some of the men involved and some of the events of this trial. As I said, this is a difficult passage to harmonize, if you want to know exactly what happened and when. And I think it's best that we remember, while chronology can be important, when it comes to the Gospels, we must trust that if they didn't feel it was important to order some of these details chronologically, then we ought to pay attention to the themes and details and the way that they did present them. That will help us to see their intended message or their intended emphasis. Not only is this a technically difficult passage, but the trials as a whole are simply difficult to read, as you have to visualize the sheer amount of abuse and shame which the Lord accepted on our behalf. As we close our study, think about your life in light of what the Lord has done. He suffered it all. He faced the cross. He gave up his life for you and for me. And our study today has been full of dark and difficult realities from the last days of Jesus. But he rose again. He conquered death and the grave. He paid the price of our sin, and now he lives forever as King of Kings, Lord of Lords. He ministers as our great high priest. He's brought to us all salvation. Are you in good standing with the King? Are you one of his citizens? If not, then it's time to decide. Will you obey the gospel call if you have not already and become a child of God? Will you accept the wonderful sacrifice made on your behalf when Jesus gave his life in your place to redeem you from sin? If you're a Christian but have turned back to the ways of sin and are not living in full obedience to God, come back to him today. If we can assist you in baptism or in repentance and confession to God, we invite you to come forward while we sing.